My name is Amber Stone, and on behalf of the Lincoln City Academic Affairs Commission, I'd like to welcome you all to Lost Lecture Series. Our Lost Lecture Series is largely inspired by the story of Dr. Randy Hutch, a former Carnegie Mellon professor who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and before passing away gave one last lecture titled "Really Achieving Your Childhood Dream." In his lecture, he examined his life, and in doing so, hoped to enable the dreams of others, most notably his children and his students. And so, in the spirit of Dr. Couchin's last lecture, chosen faculty are prompted to answer this question. If you were to give your last lecture ever, what would you tell students? And so, with that, I would like to introduce Matthew Lang, who will provide a brief testimony for our student speaker, before we invite Professor Gavetti to join us. Thank you.
I'm giving testimony here, so be afraid, Dr. Gavetti. When I was an undergraduate several years ago, Dr. Gavetti was my academic advisor. And over the years of having him as an academic advisor in my very formative years, I learned many lessons and I heard a lot of stories. And I also, sometimes I make up words, and so I made up a word, Gavettiism, and to describe some of the things that Dr. Gavetti has given me. And the first one that the first Gavettiism that I have from Dr. Gavetti was, it's not quite a story, and yet, is that you hear a train, but you can't see a light. How long do you wait to see if it's really coming? I don't think it was his intent, but of course, I went through the next, you know, couple of years of my life really just trying to avoid train wrecks. aside from the Gavettiisms, Dr. Gavetti really encouraged me to think broadly as a scholar. His stories of adventure in Botswana, Egypt, and Vietnam really took me places in my mind and inspired me to reach after my dreams. And his stories of Peace Corps projects going wrong and his ability to find humor in the face of things that might otherwise be considered tragic was actually was quite heroic for me. Quite unexpectedly, at the end of my baccalaureate period, I lost someone who I expected to spend the rest of my life with. And Dr. Gavetti was there, not just to listen, but to tell me stories. But these were different kinds of stories. These were stories of personal tragedy and overcoming grief. And over the next few years, we lost contact. And often, those stories I would recollect upon, and they actually gave me my perseverance to come out of those dark times. And recently I was reunited with Dr. Gavetti. Well, it seems recently now, but I guess the older you get, the longer time periods you consider recent. So it was about 7 years ago now that I reunited with Dr. Gavetti. I stopped by his office and I said, "What you doing?" And he, you know, I said, "Oh, I haven't seen you forever, blah, blah, blah." And he says, "Well, everybody thinks I'm crazy." I'm writing down all of these quotes about food from Athenaeus, in volume of work, some of our earliest writings about food. And I sat with him, and we went through his, I think it was 20 documents, well over 100 pages each, and we worked together to make a database of these quotes. And I had the amazing opportunity that Dr. Gravetti invited me to Paris with him and to present the results of this effort. And he even was generous enough to yield some speaking time to present. And this really sort of began my second career as a scholar. And so there are many ways in which I would like to express this gratification and my humility. And along the lines of liking to make up words again, when the Greeks have the words pathos, logos, and ethos to describe different ways of feeling very strongly. And if I could make up another word, it would be akademos, which would be the feeling of high esteem for a person's knowledge and their communication of that knowledge to me. Unfortunately, akademos is already taken. But if I could. So this last lecture series is meant to celebrate learning in all of its modalities and venues. And it's in this venue tonight that I celebrate Dr. Gravetti for transferring not just his knowledge, but his wisdom about life. And that has deeply impacted this person's life. So it's with this esteem and honor that I introduce Professor Lewis Gravetti.
In my life and the life of my family. I wish to thank Anna Marie, I wish to thank Matthew for the kind words. It was a joy to look out and see so many of my former students and roommates from Cal back years ago, people I've just met more recently. Some of you attending tonight have come from very long distances, maybe over 300 miles, and I thank you for your decision to come. I also wish to express my thanks and appreciation to the ASUCD officers in the last lecture council. But most of all, we have to thank the undergraduates who are here for the privilege of addressing you tonight. Thank you, Chancellor Vanderbilt, for attending. Thank you, all my friends and colleagues, for being here. You honor me, and I wish to do the best I can tonight to share information with you. We named the ASUCD last lecturer as an honor, but the designation really honors the life of Randy Pausch, professor of computer knowledge and literature at Carnegie Mellon University, received this concept of the last lecture. He gave his last talk in dignity, set the stage for others across the United States to follow. Randy's concept was that the speaker should not glorify his or her academic or professional accomplishments, but should acknowledge the speaker's family, mentors, individuals, and influences that have been on the speaker, identify specific pivotal points and events in the speaker's life, and share life's lessons learned. I never met a person who told me that early in their life they wanted to be a college professor. Being a professor certainly was not my original life goal. By the fourth grade, I knew exactly what I wanted to be. I wanted to go on fossil expeditions like Roy Chaplin Andrews and visit the Gobi Desert. This is to collect dinosaur bones. And this is a dream and vision that I held throughout my childhood and my early undergraduate years at UC Berkeley. My professional career at UC Davis as a professor of both geography and nutrition came in midlife, and only after a series of encounters that might be called unusual events, along with a personal willingness to take professional chances and to step through doors of opportunity, decisions that ultimately led me to a career at this great university. My undergraduate and graduate majors at Cal were paleontology, the study of fossils. My studies were augmented with complementary courses in anthropology, geology, and zoology. And how it came to be that I abandoned my interest in dinosaurs and ultimately became associated with the research in chocolate history is this winding, circuitous path that I'm going to share with you tonight. I chose graduate school at UC Davis because I wanted to work with Professor Frederick Simoon. At the time, he was a member of the Davis Geography faculty. Had Professor Simmons chosen me to be a student some years earlier, I might have graduated not from UC Davis, but from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, perhaps from LSU, or perhaps from the University of Texas Austin, where he held previously held professorship. It was Professor Simmons' departure from these institutions and his opportune arrival at UC Davis that resulted in my receiving the PhD degree from Davis in 1976. I owe much to Professor Simmons, and he taught me the fine art of writing and taught me how to be a journalist, for which I'm greatly appreciative. It is an honor for me that he is with us this evening, Professor Simmons. When I entered the Department of Geography as a PhD student, the chair was Kenneth Thompson. Kenneth's wife was Lucille Hurley, the professor in the Department of Nutrition, and internationally known for her research on trace mineral nutrition. Lucille encouraged me to take courses in nutrition and food science. She was a strong supporter of my academic program, and I valued her mentorship. Lucille in turn introduced me to Rosemary Pangborn, professor in the Department of Food Science and Technology, who had developed the first course that integrated food and culture on this campus. And because of the fine academic support and encouragement from these two important women, I completed an additional 32 units of formal nutrition and food coursework in addition to my graduate work in geography. In spring of 1976, I was hired at UCD in two departments, geography 20% and nutrition 80%. My contract called for me to develop courses on a research program that integrated geography with a research program in community nutrition and food habit research, whether from historical or contemporary perspective. When I was hired, between April 76, when I was hired, and July 2008, when I retired, I designed and taught 29 different classes. I had the honor of teaching more than 29 graduate students, many of whom are here tonight, over 6,000 students, and serving as the major mentor for 37 master's and PhD students. Thank you for those of you who are my students who are attending tonight. It gives me great joy that you attend. Now, one factor has characterized my life from the beginning and represents the primary reason that I became a professor at this great university. This factor was my willingness to take risks and to abandon my early interest in studying dinosaurs, to abandon my upper division and graduate student training in micropaleontology, and to embark upon a life-changing experience in a field I had not previously studied. I accepted a unique opportunity for employment in the Middle East. In that distant and culturally distinct and widely misunderstood part of the world, I experienced the joys of courtship and marriage. There I also experienced the trials of being caught up in the Six-Day Arab-Israeli War of 1967. In essence, I followed Robert Frost's advice and took the road less traveled. So with this bit of background, let me begin at the beginning. I stem from a complex, very complex, but loving family. Our ethnic roots are derived from a sweep of nations on three continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe. My Italian ancestors originate in the Piedmont region of what is now northwestern Italy, just north of the Torino, the town called Rivarolo di Canavese. Our family surname originally was not Rivetti, but Rivetto. I regret to say that Italian was not spoken within our family home in America. My Irish family roots stem from County Clare. After immigration to America during the early 19th century, my great-great-grandfather Solomon Quinn settled in Providence, Rhode Island. His son Frank Quinn, my great-grandfather, enlisted in the Federal Army at the age of 15 and served as a drummer boy in the American Civil War until his capture at the Battle of Petersburg. After the Union defeat at Petersburg, he was captured and incarcerated at a Confederate concentration camp at Salisbury, North Carolina, until his release at the end of the war. His daughter Lottie, my paternal grandmother, married my grandfather Dominic. By this time, however, the spelling of our name had changed from O to I for reasons we have no understanding about. And the couple settled in the homestead in northeast of Harlingen, Montana. My father Rex was one of six children born to Dominic and Lottie, and only three of these people survived into their late 20s. My maternal family roots originated somewhere in England, we don't know where. My distant ancestor, Benjamin Carpenter, immigrated to North America prior to the Revolutionary War. He was a six-month man and he signed on with the New Hampshire Regiment. according to family tradition, Benjamin was present at the hanging of Major John Andre, who, as you recall, collaborated with Benedict Arnold to secure the fortress at West Point for the British, and later was executed by American rebels. Some descendants of Benjamin remained in New Hampshire, while others in the early 1800s headed south and west for the Ozarks, or southwestern Missouri. There they established themselves as hill people, stills and all. Still, other maternal relatives abandoned New Hampshire and settled in eastern Tennessee prior to the American Civil War. My maternal great-grandmother on the left photograph was 13 years old when President Lincoln was assassinated. I knew this woman. I spoke with her. So tonight, you have a link between 2012 and the assassination date of President Lincoln. Although living in Tennessee, her parents supported the Union, and her kin forced this branch of her family to move elsewhere. So together, they walked on foot 500 miles from eastern Tennessee to Illinois, where they settled in East St. Louis. I was born in Billings, Montana in 1938, and during the earliest years of my life, we lived in Bozeman and subsequently in Harlingen, Montana, a small farming cattle town on the Muscle Shoal River, a town that was initially characterized in my youth by unpaved main streets with seven or eight bars and remnants of fishing posts outside the very store. My paternal grandfather, Grand Dominic Gravelli, was appointed the first sheriff of Whitman County, Montana. He packed a pistol, he organized posses, they hanged people, and generally ran a loose town. He served one term before being voted out of office. My father, Rush Gravetti, grew up in this house. A smattering of chickens, goats, and a pet antelope characterized my father's play yard. He would become the first member of our family on either side to graduate from college. And from this humble beginning, my father would rise to become the chief petroleum officer, geologist of Texaco. He was responsible in part for discovering the Santa Barbara Channel finds and along the Alaska North Slope. My Irish-American grandmother, who lived in this house, seen here, completed 2 years of college before illness prevented her from graduating. Now, before her marriage and relocation to Montana, she was an accomplished pianist. In contrast, my grandfather had finished just the fourth grade before he ran away from home to seek his fortune. Arriving in Montana, the couple built this house, and soon after these pictures were taken, my grandfather gave up farming. And after his term as sheriff ended, he was employed by the Milwaukee Railroad. My grandmother told me late in life that the only piano in town was at the local house of ill repute, where she became friends with the madam, who allowed her to practice the piano several times a week. In fact, I played the piano very well. I was able to put myself through part of my graduate school years at Berkeley, tinkling the ivories at two bars. I owe at least a part to the encouragement of this tough, strong Irish-American grandmother. During World War II, my father was part of a strategic defense unit for the U.S. Geological Survey that mapped coal prospects throughout the Pacific Northwest. During this period, we lived in a succession of towns identified here. At the conclusion of World War II, my father joined Texaco as a petroleum geologist, where we lived in Vernonia, Oregon, and subsequently in Santa Paula, California, where in 1952, I entered high school. In the summer of 1955, I was one of four students selected by my high school to represent the United States through the AFS, the American Field Service Exchange Student Program, between my junior and senior year. The American Field Service assigned me to a family in Flensburg, northern Germany, where memories of the Nazi era and World War II defeat still remain strong. I saw and experienced personally the ruins of Bremerhaven, Hamburg, and Cologne. Some of the families I met that summer remained steadfast to the National Socialist dogma of the Nazi Party. Others, however, had rejected fascism. We 16 American high school students living that summer in Flensburg heard German excuses for the invasions of Denmark and Norway. We were chastised more than once at social gatherings because American troops had stopped at the Oder River, a military decision that allowed the Russians, our allies of World War II, to occupy Berlin. All in all, my life experiences with AFS were life-shaping. Throughout grammar school into high school, I wanted to be a paleontologist that studied dinosaurs. My senior year at Santa Paula High School, I applied to only one university, UC Berkeley, because at the time, only Cal, of all the campuses in the United States, it was the only one that had an undergraduate major in paleo. When I received my admission letter from Cal, I was confused. I was assigned to a woman's residence hall. The letter was addressed to Louise Gravel. My mother made me contact the registrar's office immediately when my father was mine. How could my life have been different if I showed up at that point? I entered Cal September 1956 at the age of 17 and ultimately was assigned to Bowles Hall, the first residential college foundry in the United States. It gives me great pleasure to recognize that several of my Berkeley undergraduate and graduate schoolmates and roommates are attending tonight. Thank you for coming to London. Arriving at Berkeley, I quickly found that I was a little frog in a very huge puddle. Everyone at Cal was smart. I grew through high school, fairly studied, and had maintained high grades. And keeping the same study habits, as some perhaps freshmen do on this campus, I was in for a shock. My first round of midterms at Cal were less than impressive. I had F in Chemistry 1A, and F in German 1, and D in ROTC, the requirement that all lower division men at Berkeley had to take the time. But at least I had a B in my half-unit fencing class. I immediately sought tutoring help from my parents at an astonishing cost of $300, almost half my father's take-home pay at the time. This $300 today would be an equal in value to $2,400 in today's dollars. And that was a sum equal to my semester cost for room and board, $300 a semester. By the end of the first semester, my tutors had helped me raise my GPA to a 2.1. What I realized in this experience was that the stark realization I'd have to study hard and manage my time better. At the conclusion of my second semester, I'd elevated my GPA to an overall 3. Then came the second year. I thought I knew it all. My experience was commonly called the sophomore slump. My third semester GPA was a 1.6. During my third semester at Cal and during my fourth grade semester, an event occurred that impacted me and many of my friends. On October 4th, 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first Earth-orbiting satellite. It's difficult today to imagine and understand the fear and apprehension surrounding this event that we students felt. We knew that the Soviets had this thing up there in space. We also were fearful because we believed that subsequent Soviet satellites could hold nuclear devices. And with the Kremlin leader's fingers on the button, that was all over. Now, thinking back, what many of my friends and I eventually realized was that this event was well beyond our control. Sputnik was up there. We could do nothing about it. Left the President Eisenhower to have to deal with it. And history shows that he, the subsequent American presidents, did so. During my undergraduate years at Cal, we also were concerned with two additional issues. The first was the so-called domino theory, based upon the assumption that the communists would roll down Southeast Asia from China to Vietnam, then into Thailand, to Burma, then into India, Pakistan, then to Thailand, to Burma, India, Pakistan, and then to the Persian Gulf. And then with all that oil, it's all going to be over. The second fear was fear of the bomb. In the late 1950s, some of my Cal friends and I believed that the bomb was in fact coming. It wasn't if it was coming. It was only when. What we ultimately learned from these geopolitical events was that good hopes and thinking about peace is naive. We learned and accepted the principle that peace had to be achieved through hard work, diplomacy, covert activities, coupled with on-site verification. These were lessons learned then and with applications still today. People can wish all they want, but wishes do not assure national security. The bomb is real. Have any of you attending tonight ever seen the flash of an atomic blast? Raise your hand. I have as well. Number 8 bomb blast, the Yucca blast in Nevada, were televised in the early mornings of 1955. And such blasts are terribly eerie, and afforded us, for those of us who watched, he had a brief look into the potential abyss of Armageddon. Now, during my undergraduate years at Cal, we were required to enroll in breath classes, called GD classes today at UC Davis. How we hated those requirements. They were unrelated to our courses. We didn't want them. They seemed a little used to us. One of my Bowles Hall friends at the time, Bruce Ramsey, alerted me that ARC 1A would be a sin. Since Professor Daryl Hemmings, all he did was show slides. So Bruce and I enrolled in ARC 1A, and while many in the class slept, I looked at these slides and was enthralled. Looked at the wonders of Mesolithic and Neolithic art, especially the art of ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, Phoenicia, Mesopotamia, and Persia. Little did I realize at the time that these images and influences ultimately would bring me into the academic fields of nutrition and geography. As a result of this class, I made a mental commitment after graduation and completing my military obligation that I would travel to the Eastern Mediterranean countries and see the ruins of ancient Egypt, Greece, and Rome. Afterwards, I settled down and established my career as a paleontologist. But that career option did not work out. I planned to become a bush pilot in Alaska. The lesson learned here, do not judge a breath course merely by its name. You never know how the content of a breath course can influence your life forever. Throughout my undergraduate years, I worked summers to pay for my education. I worked as an oil field roustabout for Texaco at South Mountain near Santa Paula and at San Bernardino north of Paso Robles. Minimum wage at that time was $1.10 an hour. My roustabout pay was $2.25, so I could save enough money for my university fees and expenses from September until about the end of February, early March. Whereupon my parents would then help out and pay the rent. Hang on your chairs. The school fees at Cal that I were considerably lower than they are at UC campuses today. My first year at Cal, 1956, we paid $45 per semester for tuition. And we complained when it went to $65 2 years later. We paid about $300 per semester for room and board contracts. And an expensive textbook cost about $10. On August 11, 1960, at the Santa Arda oil field north of Paso Robles, an explosion killed two of my co-workers, one badly injured. I worked that afternoon as a welder's helper, and through a management supervision error, gas and oil had leaked from the wellhead into the gauge tank transfer lines of your welding. I heard the initial of escaping gas and jumped to the right. The explosion knocked me about 10 feet through the air, but outside of the cone of the blast, the fireball. Everything around me was on fire. I felt terrible heat, but curiously no pain. The pain would come shortly later after the adrenaline jolt had worn off. I crawled through the burning brush to safety and survived. And I jumped to the left when I first heard the hissing from the escaping gas, I would die. But from this dramatic experience, I learned firsthand that life is precious and accidents happen. One never knows the number of one's days. There's a passage in the Old Testament. Men go and come, but earth abides. When and where one dies is not foretold, and the manner and place of one's death is just part of the grand lottery of life. I graduated from Cal with an AB degree in June 1960. In September of that year, I entered graduate school at Cal in the Department of Paleontology to work on my master's. At this time, I had given up on dinosaurs. There were a few jobs available for dinosaur hunters, but there were significant employment opportunities. He studied microforans to work for specifically as an geologist. During this period of my education, my major professor was Zach Arnold, who introduced me to the exciting world of living microorganisms. My interest again shifted from fossils to living single-cell organisms. I conducted my thesis research on the Farallon Islands off San Francisco. There, with the help of my brother John, I studied the ecology and distribution of intertidal foraminifera. My Farallon Islands experience reinforced my desire to work with single cell organisms. This desire, however, would change dramatically a few years later. During my last year of graduate school, I held a series of part time jobs, and one of these was playing ragtime piano at the Bowles Pizza on Northside, where the banjo players and I had received free food and beer and developed a reasonable following. We were fired after a local musicians union threatened to put up a picket line. So as the saying goes, if you can't beat them, you have to join them. So I joined the union, was hired at Larry Blake's restaurant on Telegraph Avenue, where I played dinner music and sing-along songs downstairs at the Larry Blake's Rathskeller. For each five-hour effort, three times a week, I received $33. A salary of $99 a week was a sum that was twice the salary of a graduate student teaching assistant at the time. For my third part-time job during graduate school, I identified samples of plankton and single-cell algae or diatoms for a company called Engineering Science, based in Oakland. I did not know at the time, but that this training ultimately would present the next opportunity for a new stage in my life and personal development. In spring 62, just prior to my graduation with my master's, I learned from colleagues in Engineering Science at the United States Public Health Service needed an officer to manage the plankton diatom lab in Cincinnati, Ohio. At that time, the USPHS was one of the ways that men could satisfy their military obligation. So I applied for the officer's corps, passed a physical and interview, was sworn in, and received a commission as Lieutenant JG. I then drove across the United States from Berkeley to Cincinnati in my 1956 Chevy and reported for active duty on July 1st, 1962. The lesson here, more employment opportunities result from personal contacts and networking than they ever by mailing, posting, or handing out to college resumes. Many in the audience tonight will recall that 1962 American involvement was just getting started in Vietnam. For a while, I toyed with the idea that that would be Steve helicopter training and could in fact join the Marines. I did wear glasses at that time, and it wasn't as heavy as I am now. I was a slim 135, and we played intramural or intercollegiate soccer for 4 years. But I traded the idea of helicopters and a potential post-career as a bush pilot for a commission in the U.S. Public Health Service. And then sat there for 2 years and identified the freshwater diatoms and microinvertebrates in the water supply system of the United States. In October 1962, President Kennedy announced that the Soviets had established missile launching capacity in Cuba. For those of you who remember the events now called the Cuba Missile Crisis, think back and recall the uncertainty and fear that you felt when President Kennedy said the following words on television that fateful Monday evening, October 22nd. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response from the Soviet Union. The next day, on Tuesday morning, our unit commander assembled us officers and assigned us to task in preparation for a presumed atomic attack in Cincinnati. We're all very nervous, and we expected the worst. Some officers were assigned to inspect civil defense bomb shelters within the greater Cincinnati area. We reported back later that afternoon that most of the shelters lacked food and water. How could this be? Did not our government have well-developed civil defense plans? As the officers continued giving their report, we became more and more ill at ease, and it was clear to us that Cincinnati was unprepared for an atomic attack. My specific assignment was this, according to my commanding officer. My unit was to go to the pump through the motor pool, check out a vehicle, drive north towards Dayton, Ohio, out of Cincinnati, and then establish a checkpoint near around Lebanon, about 25 miles out north, to measure the radiation levels of civilian refugees and survivors. Now, we didn't think much of that assignment, given that our water quality lab was right square plunk in the middle of downtown Cincinnati, and the motor pool was right next to the GE jet engine factory. What I learned from this experience was that government plans to protect civilians can go awry. Individuals and communities need to be independent and self-reliant and not look to federal government for help or protection. It did not surprise me that many years later, the local, county, state, and federal response to Hurricane Katrina was uneven and insufficient. But reason prevailed. The bomb did not come. The Cuban Missile Crisis diffused, and today is but a distant memory. In June 1964, I was discharged from active duty and accepted the position as research assistant to Professor William J. Darby in the Department of Biochemistry Division of Nutrition at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Professor Darby was one of the most highly respected biochemists and nutritionists of the era, and was through a chance that I learned he was assembling a research team in Egypt to investigate the role of trace metals and zinc in human growth and sexual maturation. During the last 6 months of my military service, I have written more than 100 letters seeking employment in the Middle East. None have been successful. This employment opportunity with Vanderbilt came about through a chance meeting over lunch. I entered the commissary, sat down at a table next to a guy I'd never met before. He had a lab down the hall. We were talking about getting out of service, what we planned to do. Well, I'd like to go to the Middle East. He said, well, you know, my dad works for the Office of Naval Research in D.C., the United States has a hospital, a Navy hospital in Cairo. I said, that's impossible. First of all, we don't get along politically. And secondly, Cairo's landlocked. So why would there be a Navy hospital in Cairo? There's one there is. I never would have learned about the Darby Egypt connection if I had not sat at that table. There's two basic life lessons here. Do not be discouraged in your job search, you undergraduates. You have no reason to complain until you've written at least 100 letters. And when the next rejection letter arrives, do not despair. Keep pushing forward. The next letter that follows will be the one that meets your aspirations and professional goals. The second lesson is that doors of opportunity open and close daily. They're all around us. But it may be chance that a door of opportunity opens to you, but chance is not the issue. The issue is that you must recognize the opportunity and decide to step through that door. I contacted Professor Darby and he invited me to Nashville for an interview. After introductions, his first question caught me off guard. I expected questions about nutrition, malnutrition, X, Y, and Z. First question he asked me, what do you know about Egyptian art? That certainly was not what I expected, but the information from my art 1A class began to bubble up in my brain. I replied, yes, I do know something about Egyptian art. Well, what's your favorite temple? Yes. I replied, Hatshepsut's temple at Delphi. He said, yes. What's unusual about that temple? Well, the Queen of Punt is depicted as a beast or with a lymphatic disorder. And the Queen herself commonly is depicted wearing a beard. The interview continued, and he asked, what did I know about food that appears on the tomb and temple art? I said, well, the tomb are knocked at Thebes. They show pickling birds hunting in the marshes, winnowing grain banquet scenes, and offering food for the dead. It went on like this for about 10, 20 minutes, and the interview then concluded. We had not discussed the science of nutrition. We discussed nothing about zinc. There were no questions regarding anything about malnutrition. His last two questions to me were this. Would you be willing to learn Arabic, and would you be willing to live in an Egyptian village to assist with our project? I agree. 2 weeks later, he offered me a position with his team in Egypt. Now, what if I had taken a different suite of breath classes? What if my friend Bruce had not convinced me to take art one day? I wouldn't know anything about Gerald Bakri, Hot Steps, or anything. And what if I walked down and entered the commissary an hour earlier, an hour later, not sat at that table, never would have that contact? And we would be here this evening. So I repeat, the issue is not chance or luck. The issue is making a decision, to take advantage of the opportunities presented. I joined the Darby Nutrition Team in June of 64. I was assigned to Egypt. I would be assigned to Egypt after I completed a 6-week crash course in reading nutrition science textbooks and key journal articles. It was during these hectic weeks prior to arriving in Egypt that I read everything about trace minerals and especially zinc. So I repeat, never underestimate the value and importance of GE classes. I secured my job not because of my public health service qualifications, but because of Dr. Amix's Art When They Breath class. As a result, the course of my life changed, and as a result, I met my life partner, George Depp, who's here tonight. As a result, I ultimately became a professor at UCLA. In late August 1964, I was assigned as a civilian to the United States Naval Medical Research Unit Number 3, called NAMRU 3. In Cairo, there's a facility located in Abbasiyah, which is a suburb of Amman, Cairo. I must also share with you this point that, before going further, that my parents really disliked my decision. They were appalled, they were unsupportive, my decision to turn my back on my previous paleontology training. My father, who was a pretty big guy, he lectured me and said, what in the name of God has possessed you? You have 6 years in university training. Join some stupid nutrition program in Egypt. How can you be part of a nutrition team when your food habits and dietary habits are so poor? My father continued to chastise me. He said, look, if you want to go to Egypt, work as a micropaleontologist, and then go to Egypt after you retire at age 65. That's what a responsible person would do. I told my parents I was going. In late August of 64, I sold my 56 Chevy in Nashville for $300. God, this is a decision I regret every day. Those classic cars are now worth 20, 30, 40K right now. I found myself in Egypt, in a country governed by then, President Gamal Abdel Nasser. So I return to my primary thesis tonight, especially the words for the undergraduates and new graduate students tonight. During your lives, each of you will experience crossroads and making key decisions. Whether a comfortable, anticipated path will lead you in one direction. But if your heart is committed, your heart is committed to another unorthodox direction, then consider carefully Frost's words and follow your heart. I shall be telling you from the time, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in the woods. I took the one that's down the bottom, and that has made all the difference. Our initial attempts in late 1964 to implement zinc field trials, however, failed due to political problems. These problems ultimately were resolved through the fine efforts of another colleague, Dr. Harold Sandstead Jr., who some of you in the audience did not know. In my first 6 months in Egypt, I became sufficiently fluent in Egyptian Arabic so that when our team resumed the zinc field trial under the supervision of Dr. James Bucket Carter, I had sufficient language skills to coordinate the day-to-day zinc, iron, and placebo field trial and to organize the quarterly medical examinations of our school children. Our field site was the village of Sindyum in the southern part of the Egyptian Delta, about an hour's drive north from our hospital in Cairo. Every morning, 6 days a week, I drove a U.S. Navy ambulance and picked up the Egyptian nurses and physicians on our team. It was during this period of work in 65 that I met my future wife, Georgette Myrakis. Several critical events shaped my life while working in Egypt, and the first drew me away to any future work and interest in micropaleontology or single-celled organisms. It ultimately would bring me into the integrated fields of geography, health, medicine, and nutrition. One morning while working in Sindyum Village, two boys approached me with a concern regarding their friend. One of the boys said to me, "Mr. Lewis, we are worried about our friend." "Why?" I asked. "Because, Mr. Lewis, when the three of us go down to the canal and piss, his piss is always yellow or white. And as you know, Mr. Lewis, the true color of piss is red." Hematuria, or blood in the urine, is one of the classic physical signs of schistosomiasis, or velvetsiasis, a debilitating parasitic disease where worms enter the body through contact with irrigation water. The worms meet up and mate inside the body. The female lays eggs with sharp spines. They come down through your urinary tract system. They go out through your ureters, and you pee blood. After just two urine tests, 65% of these children at Sindyum School tested positive for schistosome eggs in their urine or for hematuria. And the lesson I learned from these two perceptive Egyptian boys is that health is relative. Now, truly, think tonight. I would expect that any of you, if you look down the toilet bowl later this evening, saw blood in your urine, and you'd immediately make an appointment either tonight or tomorrow to see your doctor. But not so at that time in Egypt. For these Egyptian boys, bloody urine was considered normal. The oddity was not having red urine. This event became so pivotal in my life that I renewed my contract with Vanderbilt University, and I made the medical professional commitment to remain in the health field and to work internationally. A triad of events during 1967 also remained critical in life-shaping. And these were my marriage, experienced firsthand the six-day war between Egypt and Israel, my incarceration under hotel arrest and evacuation from Egypt, and subsequently our refugee status in Greece. Now, with war clouds looming, Georgette and I decided to move up the date of my marriage, which had been in the schedule for July to 15th of July. And with the blessing of Georgette's mother, we were married twice. In late May of 67, the first on Thursday, May 25th, in civil ceremony, and the following Sunday, May 27th, in Greek ceremony. The next day, Georgette was required by the American Embassy to evacuate as American dependent. Although I was a new groom, the American Embassy required me to remain behind. Hostilities broke out on Monday, June 5th, when Israel launched a preemptive strike against Egypt, whereupon all Americans remaining in Egypt were declared persona non grata and expelled. The Egyptian government ordered our evacuation from Cairo by train to Alexandria on Tuesday evening, the second day of the war. And something like these photographs of the long past terrible war in Europe, we were herded onto a train and guarded by armed soldiers, presumably headed to safety. From Cairo, the train rolled northward, and eventually we reached the eastern outskirts of Alexandria. We were ordered to disembark by other armed soldiers and forced onto new buses to be taken to an unknown destination. This destination, fortunately, turned out to be a hotel in the Mantava district of eastern Alexandria. There we were placed under guard, under hotel arrest. We were treated civilly, but were not permitted to leave. On Saturday morning, June 10th, the last day of the war, we were rousted from sleep aboard new buses about 3:45 in the morning by armed guards. And we were then taken to an unknown destination that turned out to be the port of Alexandria. Fortunately, we were treated civilly, our possessions were searched, and we were then put aboard a ship chartered for Greece. I seem to remember that there were about 450 evacuees aboard the ship that normally carried about 180 passengers. There were insufficient lifeboats, insufficient life jackets. The ship named the Corina left Alexandria late in the afternoon near the end of the 12-mile limit by two ships in the U.S. 6th Fleet, a destroyer and a destroyer escort, who led us across the Mediterranean safe haven to Greece. Dr. Charles Halstead, a professor of internal medicine here at UC Davis, and attending tonight, can attest to these events, and he likewise was aboard the Corina, Professor Halstead. What I learned from this personal experience as a civilian during wartime is that humans basically are naive. While we expect the best from our friends and least civility and decent treatment from our enemies, human survival during wartime is dictated primarily by chance and by the ethics, moral values of those in charge. On that early morning in Alexandria, Egypt, we incarcerated Americans were held only because we were Americans. We merely were pawns in a grand game of chess, for which there were only three outcomes. Life and freedom, life and incarceration, or death. In our case, we received life and freedom, but we received this gift only because our guards followed orders not to do the unthinkable, and only because of a policy of decency held by the government of Egypt at that time towards us. We were granted our lives and freedom and allowed to evacuate Egypt basically without incident, for which those of us who experienced these events will always be grateful to those who were in charge. Reaching safe haven in Athens, I reunited with my wife for death, and after 3 months sojourn in Greece as refugees, we returned to Vanderbilt. During my second Nashville period, Bill Darby, Paul Galeonubi, and I began writing a book on food, health, and medicine in ancient Egypt, an enjoyable collaboration that took several years to complete. Our efforts hopefully would take on be known as, published as Food, the Gift of Osiris. The lesson we learned together from this was that the experience that we had, these three of us, each of us had very different academic and professional backgrounds. And we were able to produce a book that was more insightful than if the topic had been approached only by an Egyptologist working alone. So by 1970, our book was published, but it was before our book was published, it was time to resume my education. Made no sense holding a master's degree in paleontology even in the biochemistry department in Nashville. So Bill encouraged me to return to school, and after applying and being accepted into various programs, I reviewed my options and enrolled as a PhD student in the Department of Geography and work with Professor Simone. In September 1970, when I arrived on campus, I would be classified by the registrar's office as a mature, older student. I was 33 years old. My wife and I had both given up great jobs so I could start graduate school. I was nervous and apprehensive at Professor Winston's test. I didn't know if I'd be successful. I had a fellowship that paid me $209 a month, but tuition and school fees were paid. My wife worked in graduate studies and offers in Morat Hall. We lived in Woodland, where our rent was $150 a month. Our graduate school years at UC Davis were influenced by a new wave of mentors, confidants, and a fine support system. I owe much of my graduate school success to my graduate student colleagues, one of them, Helen Issel, is here tonight. I owe much to my professors, and Professors Simone, Hurley, and Pangborn already mentioned, but I'd also like to mention others, Dwayne Brown, Steve Jett, Jerry Russell, Howard Schutz, just to mention a few. I also was fortunate to receive fine advice and support from former Chancellor Raymond Morrell, who I knew well. He provided me with considerable advice, and I admired him. But most of all, I owe my success in graduate school to my wife, Bridget, who listened endlessly to my complaining, who believed in me more than anyone else, that I would complete my degree. I wish to thank you so much. Early 1973, I passed my PhD qualifying exam and embarked upon a period of field work in southern Africa. The location and chart in part was chosen because of networking and keeping in contact with my former friend and colleague, Professor James Bucket Carter, who was my former supervisor in Cairo. He is now affiliated with Meharry Medical School in Nashville. And Jim hired me to be the administrative officer for his new USAID maternal and child health family planning project that he had initiated in the Eastern Kalahari Desert in the Republic of Botswana. Between April 73 and June 75, I attended to my Meharry project duties at the Ministry of Health, and then worked in the evenings and on weekends and holidays. I collected data for my dissertation. The Botswana experience was a hard work but great pleasure. The country was flat, really flat. This image shows the highest point in the country. plus one about the size of Texas, and in 1973 had a population of about 800,000 people. My primary dissertation research question was to answer the climate threat. After 8 years of severe drought between 1965 and 73, the swan of people in the eastern Kalahari Desert were not malnourished, whereas a drought of equal intensity during the same time period throughout the Sahel of Western Africa led to the death of more than 2 million people from starvation and malnutrition. So here were two similar peoples living in what is basically two similar environments, where some flourished during drought and others perished. So why is this? This is my study problem. One of the keys to swan survival, as I learned during this research period, was the importance of sustained use of edible wild plants during drought and unrest for civil war, a theme that ultimately would become a major component of my research and characterize much of my early and middle years at UCJ. I arrived in Botswana at the end of 8 years of drought. During the 2 years of actual field work, I never saw malnutrition, 14 calorie malnutrition. I never saw overt evidence for vitamin deficiency, no overt evidence for mineral deficiency. The people were well nourished after 8 years of drought. The primary lesson learned from this experience was basic but controversial. Drought does not cause famine. Famine is caused by poor food distribution networks, the breakdown of social order, and the inability to recognize edibles in one's environment. The social food sharing and food distribution networks that have been maintained during drought in the Kalahari have vanished and been lost by many cultures in the Sahel and West Africa. You know, I add there too that in Rhodesia, I lived in Botswana, the second most joyful experience of our lives after our marriage happened when we became parents to our daughter, Joanna Eleni, who died of cancer tonight. After completing my work with Meharry and on my dissertation, I applied for faculty positions at UCLA and at UC Davis. In April 1976, I was hired as an assistant professor here in two departments, nutrition and geography. Through the years, my graduate students and I have took an eclectic approach to research, and we conducted field work in Africa, Asia, Europe, and in the Americas. And the appropriate lessons learned from each activity. I'm very proud of my graduate students. I cannot list all of their accomplishments and the lessons learned, but in the short time that remains, I would like to present several examples for your consideration. Cassius Lockett worked in eastern Nigeria among both pastoral and settled Fulani. These were nomads, and made the important observation that Fulani women commonly walked 24 miles a day round trip from home to sell food for cash or to barter at local market, whereas their husbands rode bicycles to the same destination, did not permit their women to ride bicycles. This gender difference was interesting because Fulani men considered culturally and religiously inappropriate for Fulani women to ride bicycles. So when you go shopping this weekend in Woodland, there'll be a rent. Walk from Davis to Costco, then carry what you buy, bring it back with you, carry it on your shoulder, on your arms. This is essentially what these women did. Noelle Johnson conducted her field work in northeastern Thailand among the traditional Karen population. She relied extensively, and looked at that, and these people relied extensively on edible wild plants. She was a keen observer, and she had coined in her thesis as the term nutritional extinction, which has now become a widely used and ethnobotanical literature. I wish I thought of it, and she thought about it first, and she gets credit. What this means is that when you walk out tonight, between here and to Brussels Lane Street, there's probably 75 wild plants growing that you can eat. How many of those can you identify? If you can't identify them, they are nutritional extinction to you. That's what we mean by that. Potential edibles are there, but in essence, these plants are nutritionally extinct because we don't know of the culinary use. In 1985, I led two voluntary teams of plant collectors to Greece, where we sought botanical specimens that sprouted at ancient archaeological sites. We called this activity the Theseus Project, after the mythological Greek hero who had walked from Troezene to Athens to reclaim the Greek kingship. We amassed more than 2,000 sheets of fresh plant specimens that are now deposited at the age of the UC Davis Herbarium. Building upon these materials, the Theseus Project, Antonia Montalis and I studied how Greeks living in urban Athens secured their food during the terrible Nazi occupation of the city during World War II and the terrible winter of 1941-1942, when approximately 300,000 Athenians starved because the Nazis restricted food imports and for bad new residents to leave the city. Those who survived relied heavily upon edible wild plants and a variety of what we would call today lesser animal foods. Birds, cats, dogs, insects, mice, various frogs and snakes. The lesson learned from this research also was critical. Events such as war, widespread civil unrest and occupation by foreign powers, it happened very, very quickly. For months during and after such events, food supply systems are destroyed. Assume your own case. If you know how to feed yourself and your family in Davis, the food supplies from the outside are cut off. After all the Davis supermarket and local market shelves have been emptied and or looted of all remaining food items, with electricity to most sections of Davis have been cut off. What would you do to feed your family? How would you do it? Do you know what is edible and growing in your neighborhood and what is not? Would you differentiate between safe and toxic plants and animals? Would you eat laboratory mice? We have a big supply of these over here in my home. What about pet dogs and cats? What about the fish and turtles in Buda Creek and where I call? You know how to raise food in your backyard? Where would you get the seed? How long does it take to grow food? You're pretty hungry before you plant the seed and that food becomes ripe. Now, if you answer no or I don't know these questions, perhaps you should have a 6-month supply of non-perishable food in your dorm room, apartment house, or garage. But also consider that even if you amass this emergency food supply, are you going to share it? Are you going to share it with who? How will you protect it from roaming gangs and vandals and thieves when the West Davisites come over to East Davis? Now, my students and I have talked about these and learned the answers to these questions through the years. And similar questions like these are posed daily throughout the world in the 21st century. And if you have not experienced them, or if you have not considered these questions, then truly you are lucky. Dan Corlett worked among the long refugees in Sacramento, California. Hmong families had fled from communist aggression and warfare conditions within the hills of Laos. Families had risked life and limb and crossed the Mekong River into Thailand, where they were sequestered for months and sometimes years in United Nations refugee camps. Families who ultimately were airlifted to Sacramento, from Thailand to Sacramento, to start a new life. And when settled in South Sacramento, these grandmothers started herbing gardens and vacant lots and raised them into additional Hmong foods. Most of these plant foods had never before ever been analyzed for the nutritional or mineral content. But why were these lots vacant? Could they possibly be toxic sites with heavy metal contamination? So we tested both the soil and the plant and confirmed that there was no heavy metal contamination. And what we learned from these strong Hmong grandmothers was that they commonly held the key to maintaining cultural food practices and the survival of Hmong dietary customs within this urban setting of Sacramento, California. Before I conclude with comments on chocolate-related issues, I want to share one brief observation about the fragility of life and the importance of ethnobotany. The setting for the last example I'm going to share with you tonight is the Eastern Aegean island of Chios, an island important historically, but one with a very dark past. Is it conceivable that a plant, the geographical distribution of a plant, could determine human freedom or slavery? That a plant could determine human life versus death? The answer, unfortunately, for the island of Chios is yes. Consider the statue of Antiscus tree in their native habitat throughout the Mediterranean basin. You can even find it at the UC Davis Arboretum if you choose to search for it. It's there. The farmers cut its trunk and branches of resin called mastique is exuded. This resin with important culinary and economic value has been highly regarded for more than 2,500 years. Although the tree grows from regions from Portugal all the way around the Mediterranean back to Tangiers, it grows everywhere within that region. The resin can only be harvested on the island of Chios because it's only there on a specific portion of the island that the resin hardens and allows collectors to gather it. Otherwise, it remains sticky. It can't become a commercial product. So you say to yourself, well, so what? Sticky resin, what does got to do? What's it going to get at? Why is this even worth mentioning? But here's why. Before 1821, Chios was the island jewel of the Mediterranean. Many European nations had their embassies here. Chios was the western terminus of the Silk Route that linked China with the Ottoman Empire. The island was wealthy because of mesquite production, and the vast bulk of the harvested resin was sent to the Ottoman Caliph in Constantinople. In 1821, the Kayans joined other Greek revolutionaries in revolt. The Caliph was displeased at the interruption of his mesquite supply and ordered Kayan islanders to be dealt with an object lesson. The Caliph sent Turkish troops to invade the island in order to secure a continuous supply of the mesquite resin. Islanders living above the geobotanical line were expendable, soft to the north of the line, sticky, hard south of the line. Many individuals north of the line fled the advancing soldiers and took shelter inside the monastery of Neil Mani, seen here. But those who sought refugee status inside this holy place were seized, and what followed is unthinkable. The evidence cannot be denied, as we revealed just part of the remains of the Kayans were executed. Their bodies have been exhumed and the bones today are locked inside case after case after case on the island, lest anyone forget and say these things never happened. The skull at the lower left provides forensic evidence for a scimitar thrust in the skull. Others were executed by gunshot wounds to the head, leaving both an entry and an exit. Most of these skulls, however, show no overt bone related injury. These unfortunates, without their head trauma, were executed using the procedure called kazoo. The khakis were lifted, dropped, and impaled to the anus upon pointed stakes planted to the ground. A horrifying execution technique that extended suffering for several days before death. The villages were pillaged north of the geobotanical mesquite line with a bunch of different carbon. This is one such site, the village of Anapatos, where the male defenders were killed. The surviving women, knowing that they would be raped, carted off to slavery, they were collected the children. Together, the women with their small children climbed to the precipice top of the building. Holding their babies and children in their arms, they jumped to their death. The mothers chose their freedom of death instead of their life of degradation and slavery. So why mention this historical unpleasantry tonight? What possible lesson is there to be learned from this tragic event? In my case, the lesson is personal. My wife's ancestors and immediate family are from Keels Island. Our ancestral village is the village of Basin, seen here on the left, located just south of the geobotanical mesquite line. At the base of the day, the mesquite resin is still collected. And less than a quarter mile north of this village, the resin does not harden. 1821 invaders allowed my wife's distant relatives to survive because they grew and tended the trees that produced the valuable product. My case, the lesson is personal. The fact that my wife and our daughter was born, that is determined by geographical distribution of a subset of unique mesquite trees, simply because our family happened to originate from a village located geographically south of the line in the Western part of the country. When I worked on Kios, I wrote the following passage in my field notes at the time after staring at this case of bones. What have you learned by standing here, this ancient bones from yesteryear? What are the lessons you can share with peaceful people everywhere? We must recall our distant past if truly we want peace to last, but then forgive and build on trust and work for peace, a peace that's just. Now at last, we come to why you really came here tonight. I've been fortunate in my academic life to develop partnerships with a wide range of scholars and funding agencies. And none has been more valuable and satisfying to me than my friendship and support through the years from my colleagues at Mars Incorporated, especially Forrest Mars Jr., Denver Mars, Howard Yana Shapiro, Carol Schmitz, Roger Snyder, and many others. It's to Chalka that I owe much of my research activities and efforts that accumulated in 2009 in the publication of our book, Chalka, History, Culture, and Heritage. Here was just a taste of several of the images from our texts. The upper left is the wonderful lithograph by Filomero de Ledesma, dated in 1631, that shows an Aztec presenting a box of chocolate, a tripod, and a sea chariot to take the chocolate from Europe. A wonderful allegorical print, wonderful. If you look carefully, you'll see nymphs cavorting in the water, and there's some debate whether this particular image is too racist for the book cover, but you decide you want to put it on. Below left are the silver chocolate pot of accoutrements from the French Queen Marie Antoinette, preparing for her service in the year just prior to her execution. To the right, from the lithograph showing the transportation of State House ceilings, a special container used to transport this plant across the manor. Most recently, my nutrition colleague, Niles Jacquard, and I have joined a team of archaeologists at Kennesaw State University in Georgia and the University of British Columbia. Our efforts include the analysis of most ancient pottery as we search for chemical signatures that reveal compound-related residues. Our most recent publication, the National Academy of Sciences, reported that there is de facto evidence of human use of cacao based upon analysis of Olmec period pottery from Mexico dated to 2,000 years before the common era, or 4,000 years ago. Currently, our team has initiated a project in the Russian Amazon Basin along the east slopes of the Andes Mountains. Later this year, we will test pottery from 6,000 years ago. We know that these ancient people did not make chocolate, but they might have fermented the pulp inside the pottery to make a type of beer. So how do I get linked up with chocolate? The association, like so many other events in my life, was an opportunity. It's a meeting that on the Davis campus with Harold Schmidt, who was then the scientific director of the Mars. I faced a lecture on campus up somewhere in MU. And walked back to my hall, and there I encountered Harold speaking with Professor Carl King, who was then the chair of the department. Carl introduced us and said, I tell him all I to do, blah, 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 and address this history. But what if after class I decided to drive home? Look, after class I decided to have a copy of the MU or the sign of it. Well, after class I just wanted to go somewhere else. I would never have met Harold. And I would not have led to the corporate chocolate Mars and company incorporated working in chocolate products. Doors of opportunity open and close. They're presented and sometimes never again. What you decide to do when presented with a door is up to you. So be prepared for the next door to open. In conclusion, I wish to thank my mentors who encouraged me along my curious and non-linear academic path. Professor Joe Hammick, who taught me art one day, Professor Chad Arnold, who taught me the joys of microfilia, who convinced me that single cell organisms were more exciting than dinosaur bones. Professor William J. Garvey, who taught me how to balance science and humanities. Professor Simmons, who taught me how to think and how to write like a geographer. Professor Lucille Hurley, who encouraged me to take through science and nutrition courses to augment my PhD training. Professor Frank Morton, who shared with me their wisdom and taught me how to be professional at UC Davis. And others in my life, almost too many to mention, who encouraged me through the years. But I wish to name three more. First is my wife, who desperately knows my Dr. Scribetti. Our daughter, Joanna Scribetti Moore, and my son-in-law, Sean Moore. I especially wish to honor Joanna and Sean tonight to protect and serve their respective communities in Richmond and Martinez, California. So to you undergraduates who are attending, I share with you these parting words. Take only one thought home with you tonight, and it's this: relish and embrace your breath box. You never know what the future holds. Be ready when the doors of opportunity open and decide to step through as I did. I truly, from the bottom of my heart, hope that you have a breath box experience at the time that I have. So again, we arrive full circle, basically. What have I not taken that particular heart or name box? What would be happening? What would be happening then? I came at crossroads in my life. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere in pages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood. I took the one that traveled by. That made all the difference. So as we end tonight, I wish to thank my colleagues at Mars for supplying two types of chocolate for your enjoyment. The first is to call American Heritage, and was developed using a variety of American colonial era recipes. American Heritage chocolate represents a coarse grind reminiscent of how chocolate beans were ground in colonial era, and has a hint of various spices and peppers that would have been characteristic of the chocolate products produced in Boston or New York in the 1700s. The second kind of chocolate this evening represents different varieties of Dove Dark, Dove Milk Chocolate, and Dove Chocolate Cherry Swirl. Now, both the American Heritage and Dove College of Mars are supplied to you, And all of these products are less than 1 month old. But there's something else I want to share with you tonight that's considered the order. When you come up tonight, please enter here a touching bone. This is an Allosaurus, a femur from a juvenile Allosaurus. I collected this bone with my brother from Central Montana about 1948, about 150 million years old.
The earth was made yesterday. I'm 50 million years old. Gives you a nice sense of who you are, your place in history, and how things work globally. So, Tetchin, you have truly been an immense experience of dinosaurs and chocolate. Thank you very much.
I just want to invite the rest of the commission to join me on the stage so that everybody can be recognized for their work and the normal event. Presentation of the last lecture series is twofold. We aim to provide students with the opportunity to get acquainted and learn from professors in an unconventional, no textbook required way. And also, secondly, we strive to honor those exceptional professors on our campus. And so, before we all disperse, we have one surprise. Next week, Professor Gravetti and Mrs. Gravetti were generous enough to offer us a dinner for we all eat with them and talk about this and so we know them better. And as we approached the event, Christine, one of our commissioners, suggested that why not we include one attendee in this dinner so as to prolong our efforts to quote bridge the gap between students and professors. We presented this idea to Professor Gravetti and Mrs. Gravetti, and they generously agreed to host an additional undergraduate student. So without further ado, the winner of the seat at this dinner is number 308080. We would like to thank Professor Gravetti for coming tonight and for prolonging this tradition of the last lecture series. And we also thank you for coming out tonight. This is a very important event for all of us. And you know, this is also a very special event for Professor Gravetti. So please, we invite you to please try the chocolate if you haven't already. Take some home and also touch that chocolate. Have a safe journey home.